All right, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It is Thursday, February 19th at 4:21 p.m. We're in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska. Members present today, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Tilton, Senator Gray Jackson, myself, Chair Kawasaki. I'd like to thank Carrie Tupo from Senate Records and Kyla Tupo as the moderator from the Legislative Information Offices. Today we have just one item on the agenda. It is an overview on the Department of Correction report on the Alaska Native Incarceration report. We have Kendra Kloster, Director of Government Relations from the Alaska Federation of Natives, and we have with us Sandra Martinson, Director of Institutions for the Department of Corrections, who will come up and present. And I do believe we also have Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson online and other folks who can answer questions as well. Ms. Martinson.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sandy Martinson. I'm a deputy director for the Division of Institutions with the Department of Corrections. DOC was provided funding to partner with the Alaska Federation of Natives to launch a study examining the factors contributing to the disproportionate incarceration rates of Alaska Natives in the state's correctional system. DOC fully supported these efforts and took a hands-off approach to ensure the integrity of the study. Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson and I are here for any department-specific questions. Now I'd like to turn this over to Kendra Kloster, lead for AFN. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sandy. Kendra Kloster, Director of Government Relations for the Alaska Federation of Natives. We also have Katie Cueva, Research Assistant Professor, Research Associate Professor for the UAF Center for Alaska Native Health Research. If you'd state your name and your affiliation, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Kendra Kloster, Director of Government Relations for the Alaska Federation of Natives.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, Associate Professor at the Center for Alaska Native Health Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
All right. We'll just dive on in.
Dive on in.
There we go. Real quick, I wanted to give a brief overview of the team that helped put together this study, Department of Corrections and AFN, University of Alaska Fairbanks, University of Alaska Anchorage, Alaska Justice Information Center, and we have an advisory team. Two of the members are online, Dr. Charlene Upbuck and Rick Haskins-Garcia, and then we also had Alex Klegheroin and Doreen Schenkenberger, who also participated. A little bit of background to kind of set the stage here. Alaska Native people experience disproportionately high rates of incarceration, reflecting deep systematic inequalities. Alaska Native people make up about 14% to 19% of Alaska's population. However, we make up about 44% of the incarceration rate in the state prison system. But please understand that these disparities, they begin long before this justice system involvement, and I want to go back to the historical trauma, inadequate access, and behavioral health issues, and sorry, I'm just going to back up here even more so. I think about it in this way. For Alaska Native people, we're very much grounded in our land, in our place, who we are, language, culture, children, elders. Historical trauma have been brought in by our onto our communities since colonization. That has affected us through boarding schools, through disease, through the many different things that Alaska Native people have gone through, and showing our resilience in many different ways. So I just want to set that in understanding of the historical trauma that has gone through and really setting the stage for the social and economic marginalization, things that have happened to our people, however, and how resilient our Alaska Native people are. Sorry, I get a little tongue-tied. It's been a very long day.
Katie Cueva, I also want to highlight that in this background, although there's certainly an incredible amount of trauma that Alaska Native people have been subjected to and have overcome, there's also a tremendous amount of thriving and flourishing that is happening among Alaska Native people and allies in the state of Alaska. So this report not only points out the disparities and what we can do to address them, but all of the good work that is already happening that we can support to help mitigate this disparity.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So again, we'll try to identify who's talking because I know we can. I've been told we sound similar. So this is Kendra. Alaska's overall recidivism rate has declined over the past decade. However, Alaska Native people continue to have the highest recidivism rate, about 60%, according to the Department of Corrections data. And the majority of individuals who have returned to the prison system are due to probation and parole violations.
Just a note, this is Dr. Katie Cueva on the data and statistics. So the disproportionality of Alaska Native people that are incarcerated varies across time and across geography, as well as across differences, say, pretrial or institutionalized or probation and parole. And because of that variance, we know that there's an opportunity for improvement. We know that we can look at places that have less disproportionality and learn from them, as well as investigate more further into places that have a greater amount of disproportionality to see what's happening there and be able to bring them into line with other jurisdictions or times when things were better.
And Kendra Kloster, reducing the disparities is not only a matter of justice, but cost effectiveness is a pathway to healthier, safer, and resilient communities throughout Alaska, which brings us to House Bill 66, which was passed in 2024. Within that omnibus crime bill was an amendment that was put in for the Department of Corrections to conduct a study with an Alaska Native organization to looking at the incarceration rates for Alaska Natives and to create recommendations to reduce both initial encounters with the prison system and the recidivism rates. I'm not going to read through this, but I just wanted you to be able to see what House Bill 66 included, and that is looking at restorative justice programs, at-risk youth, early mental health, housing, low-income housing options, drug and alcohol misuse treatment, job training, mentoring opportunities, digital training, and then number 8 was identifying federal grant programs. And so those were the 8 different areas that we looked at throughout the study. And again, this is just saying who was involved in this, the Department of Corrections and UAA looking at the DOC data. UAF conducted interviews, surveys, literature review, and I think the important part to understand with the literature review of why this was included, there's been a lot of different studies around this, and we wanted to make sure we had incorporated a number of the different studies, and I think they even found things back from the 80s of looking at different things that we can be looking at to decrease the recidivism rates and help me.
Sure. Dr. Katie Cueva to jump in. So the scope of this project is important to understand because it tells you both what's included as well as the things that we did not look at. So in our literature review, we were looking at the evidence base that already exists on what's working well in Alaska or other contexts that might be translatable to Alaska, as well as opportunities that we have to bring in programs that are evidence-based in other places.
Yes, thank you. And then Kendra, and the last thing was the community listening session that we hosted at the AFN annual convention. I'm not going to read through all of this, but we're just going to kind of give some highlights of we have some going through the recommendations, looking at the restorative justice and tribal court programs. Again, with Alaska has a strong history of alternative courts, and what I really appreciate is our tribal court and therapeutic court programs. And I'm actually going to call on Rick Garcia, who's online, because he has such a strong involvement within our tribal courts and sums it up very beautifully. So, Rick, can I call on you? Is he online?
Yes, of course, Kendra.
Thank you.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon. Rick Haskins Garcia through the chair. Kendra, I'm sorry. What would you like for me to speak with the committee about?
Tribal courts.
Oh, yes, of course. Thank you. And through the chair, as everyone in the room recognizes, there are 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. Each has the authority and jurisdiction to have their own independent and sovereign tribal courts. Tribal courts are courts of general jurisdiction, so they're able to hear a wide variety of cases. And we do share concurrent jurisdiction on certain types of cases with the state justice system as well as federal justice system. Recently, through the Violence Against Women Act 2022 reauthorization, tribes in Alaska have the ability or the pathway to exercise criminal jurisdiction over non-Native offenders who commit certain domestic violence or related crimes in our Alaska Native villages. There's a pilot project currently in Alaska, and as of right now, there are no tribes that are exercising that criminal jurisdiction, but there are tribes that are moving towards that. When we start talking about Natives, either Alaska Natives or Natives from other tribes, downstate tribes, at this time, Alaska tribes can exercise full civil and criminal jurisdiction over their own citizens and citizens of another tribe. That jurisdiction, that ability on the criminal side does not require any approval from the Department of Justice. But when we start talking about our non-Native offenders, that's when we have to seek approval from the Attorney General Bondi with the Department of Justice.
And Kendra Kloster, I'm just going to add on to that. One of the points with tribal courts is they have a restorative justice approach and very much of a healing-centered approach. For example, even looking at the UAF interview participant, facing your aunties and uncles is a little bit more scarier when going in front of them. And the restorative justice approach then is not necessarily just you're going to commit them with, put them in jail, commit a crime, you're done. You're going to go and you're going to have a, you're going to go, if you're going to have a vandalism case, for example, you're going to go back, you're going to restore that individual, and you're going to face your community. And it might be you're going to go fish for that family for a while, or you're going to clean up what you messed up, and you're going to be responsible for that. And when those kinds of cases have come forward, the youth indiscretions from those cases have basically they straightened up, right? And so we have seen that proven through our tribal court systems. And so this is something that we have talked a lot about is strengthening our tribal courts and really having those community center approaches of what we need to be looking at more into and supporting more of.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, so one of the things that we heard repeatedly during our interviews from Alaska Native and allies with expertise in this area from throughout the state was that there was a need for additional support for tribal courts, that there were tribal courts, but they didn't exist in all communities. So to support communities to create tribal courts where they didn't exist, and to also support communities that did have tribal courts to be able to expand the purview of the kinds of cases that they saw. So many tribal courts saw custody cases or domestic violence cases, but being able to expand that to additional things was something that our interview participants requested. They also told us that a number of tribal courts were operating with minimal to no funding, and so a volunteer-based court system is rather challenging to continue in a sustainable way. So wanting increased collaboration and cooperation with state agencies and increased funding to be able to support the work that's happening.
And I'm going to move on to, Kendra Kloster, move on to number two, recommendations for early intervention. Investing in early childhood into early childhood and community programs, supporting parents with free or low-cost culturally grounded parenting support and mentorship, funding programs that strengthen culturally identity, language, subsistence, and land connection. I'm going to have you expand on that because with your interviews.
Sure, Dr. Katie Cueva. So talking about early intervention for young people, effective programs are almost always cheaper and have a greater impact than intervening later in time, simply because of the age at which one intervenes. So thinking about interventions as early as possible, including prenatal care to prevent things like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. If you can set a young person up in a good way very early in life, if you can prevent adverse childhood experiences, things like parenting programs, culturally relevant parenting programs, as well as access to early interventions, free or reduced cost access to high quality, culturally relevant early childhood education and preschool programs are just an incredible bang for the buck, a really high return on investment compared to catching people once they already become involved in the criminal justice system, even in the juvenile justice system. Because as this quote from an interview participant, you know, once young people are already starting to show signs that something is going wrong, it is harder and it's more costly to intervene at that time versus catching folks when before anything bad is happening, being able to help preserve them and set them on a good path earlier in life.
And Kendra Kloster, I just want to add on this, you know, as a Native person, as we're very, you know, elders are very much at the center, you know, of our learning, and putting elders into our schools. And like, I know, you know, that's who we learn from. I learned a lot from my grandma, and that's where my sense of place really comes from, is my grandmother, my elder, and the land that I come from. And so having these cultural based programs are setting us up for success. It is being able to hunt. It's being able to fish. It's being able to learn our way of life that is setting us on that path. And for me, that has grounded me in so many different ways and has grounded my children in so many different ways. And I can't imagine for kids not having that, especially for young Native children. And I think putting that into our school systems and putting it in through, even be like, I've talked with folks about putting in through our foster care system, is ensuring that as Native children that we have that sense of place and how important that is. And we heard that through interviews too. When individuals that are incarcerated got moved, you know, to other facilities outside, their sense of place was completely thrown off because we are such land-based people and connected in that way. And so I really have to stress that point of our culturally based programs that are so important to us and to our language and to our way of life. And that's just setting us up for success. Again, I think that's going into number three, improving mental health and treatment. Again, it's that I think that I can say that exact same thing for that, requiring our culturally responsive programming in that same way. And so we've heard this again over and over again. So you might hear me say this on culturally based programs, probably through every single one of these. When we're thinking about this is shaped by intergenerational trauma. So looking at early intervention for childhood trauma and preventing the juvenile justice involvement. So there was a highlighted need for trauma engaged and culture responsive services all across our cities and in our villages. So expanding funding for early mental health screening and diagnosis, supporting trauma engaged care and culturally responsive services. And also expanding Medicaid and other reimbursement pathways to support Alaska Native-led service models.
And Dr. Katie Cueva, in our surveys of organizational representatives of folks that were working in this field in Alaska, this was what they identified as the highest priority to prevent incarceration and recidivism was additional support for mental health. However, they also identified mental health as one of the areas that was significantly lacking in funding and staff compared to other areas that we asked about. We also heard in interviews that there was a need for an equal recognition of culturally based mental health services. So in rural Alaska, appropriate mental health care might not look like telemedicine or talk therapy. It might look much more like conversations with elders and having an individual who's trusted in that community take young people out on the land to go hunting and fishing. So being able to recognize and have those services available, perhaps have those services reimbursed or at least facilitated so that they're accessible to people in rural Alaska was an area of priority.
Kendra Kloster, moving on to recommendations number four, looking at housing, increasing housing to reduce homelessness and justice contact. I think you probably hear housing coming up quite often, everything from teachers to public safety, and the same is for those individuals coming out of incarceration, is how are we expanding? We need to expand reentry housing, affordable housing, that also has integrated services such as substance misuse treatment, mental health, and job support. Providing support for individuals to access, because that was another barrier of, you know, if you have a record of being able to access some of the services if you do have a record coming out. And also culturally grounded reentry housing programs, particularly in rural and in hub communities.
Dr. Katie Cueva, I'll jump in here. We heard frequently in our interviews information about housing and homelessness is tied to probation and parole conditions. So I'm going to read you this quote that is on the slide, which is from one of our interview participants. This individual shared, "To me, it contributes to homelessness in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, in Ketchikan, in Juneau, because a lot of times these court orders say they have to stay in these urban places to receive anger management, alcoholism treatment. They got to receive evidence that they know how to get a job and how to get around. But they don't support them. They just kind of toss them out there, and you have to try to survive. And a lot of them fail. They end up on the streets, and then they get rearrested for hanging out with other felons. So consequently, a lot of Native inmates are doing time on the installment plan, as I call it, because they get violated again, and it's kind of a never-ending cycle. Some inmates whose original sentence was 3 or 4 years can end up serving much longer periods of time because of these violations." And we heard something similar, a similar sentiment from a number of different individuals where they talked about a person coming out of serving their time and perhaps having a house, maybe even a new house in their home community, but being required to stay in a community where they didn't have access to housing, and so a forced houselessness that led to a vicious cycle of reincarceration. We also heard examples of individuals who returned to their community, but then were unable to meet their parole or probation conditions because they didn't have the funds to return to an urban center to complete a required piece of their probation or parole, so then were reincarcerated.
We'll take a brief question. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I'm wondering, through tribal courts or therapeutic courts, do you also have or is there available reentry services to help deal with some of these struggles that folks have when they come out of prison in this situation?
Rick might be better at this, but I believe that tribal courts have a different scope of work. So this is what I'm talking about here is really in reentry, which is outside of the bounds of kind of tribal courts and specifically as related to housing. You really need reentry programs that have housing available or a way to achieve probation and parole conditions in a location where an individual has access to housing, which might be in a different community.
Can I rephrase my question?
Sure.
So much like we can see the good outcomes of therapeutic courts and tribal courts, is there an appetite to have a similar construct surrounding reentry and housing, and then through standing up that construct, could we prove a pilot model that then works, and then we can make sure we have state law tailored to a system that works, and then we can get people into that construct so that we can have effective reentry?
I'm going to go, this is Dr. Katie Cueva, and I would say that I think that there are programs that are attempting to work towards that vision. I'm thinking of Sean Lute has a holistic reentry program. I think kind of evaluating those programs was beyond the scope of this report, but I would hope that any of these that are acted on would have an evaluation feature that would look at what programs are already existing that are working really well, and if we scale those up, does that, or translate them to other communities, is that helping address this issue?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Kendra Kloster, moving on to number 5. And recommendations for increasing access to alcohol and drug misuse treatment. I would say a couple of the things that really came up through working on this report was providing substance misuse treatment for individuals that are incarcerated, and also providing treatment for when coming out. As we know, there are oftentimes long wait lists, and individuals that are, who, when are they ready to seek treatment, there is just not space. And I've heard this often from even just individuals within my life through the years that have, you know, gone through needing treatment and it's not available in the state, and then we lose them, or they go down a bad path and they end up incarcerated or reincarcerated. So really looking at how we can provide more substance treatment within the correction system when they're there, and also providing that when we're out. Again, looking, and I think partnership, again, this came up, partnerships with our tribal communities as well. I had a really good conversation just yesterday when with Richard Peterson over at Tlingit and Haida, and talking about the programs that they have in the reentry, and I'm excited to go and tour them with him, because they're looking at, they have the some reentry programs here that they do through the tribe, and that's really important things to learn about, because they are, as I said, the cultural-based programs are incredibly important. So how can the state be working with our tribes and learning from them, and how can we do that? Because those are programs that are working really well for our communities, and how can we learn from them as well? And so I'm going to see if you wanted to add anything to that. But.
Sure. This is Katie. Just to emphasize one point. So in our literature review, it emerged that substance misuse treatment available to everyone who's incarcerated is one of the cheapest and most effective ways to address substance misuse in this population that interacts with the criminal justice system. And addressing those long waits to treatment would be immensely beneficial, even thinking kind of circling back around to that early intervention. So if there's, say, a pregnant individual who is ready to receive treatment and they have to wait, then we have the next generation who is born already subjected to trauma and beginning that cycle one more time.
Dr. Cueva, I have a question about that. While a person is incarcerated, did you study at all the use of Vivitrol or like sort of long-term substance use disorder treatments for helping people basically recover?
Vivitrol is not something that came up in our lit review, but it's something that we could certainly look into.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Looking at, again, Kendra Kloster, moving to recommendation number 6 that we looked into for strengthening job training and mentoring programs. Through the study of looking at career training during incarceration combined with reentry support and increasing Alaska Native representation within the criminal justice field came up quite often, individuals, and I think that this quote kind of sums it up, and I'm just going to read that. Sorry, but they need to start hiring more Native correctional officers and probation officers. They need to be hiring more lawyers, Native attorneys that can either act as public defenders or the prosecutor's office. We need more Native judges. I think there's opportunities here that we can be looking for to expand our educations, our job training, and apprenticeship programs during incarceration and reentry. And I know that some of our, you know, our universities have programs, but also what can we be doing to expand, you know, programs? And one of those ways is through, what I want to say is through, one of the things we need to look at is at broadband, for example. When I think of things, we talk about telehealth, we talk about workforce development and all those things and jobs that we could possibly have for Alaska due to being remote, but it always comes back to broadband too. And so that conversation also has been interweaved in a lot of these things when we talk about training and mentoring, is how are we going to be able to support it through some of these online programs that are available. But sometimes we just can't get broad. We just don't have broadband available like we do here in, you know, in our urban centers. So that is a piece that I think that we need to really look if we're going to expand educational opportunities out in rural Alaska, is being able to support the broadband efforts to make sure our communities can have those the opportunities to even do that out in rural Alaska. I have a lot of conversations with people out in rural Alaska of how much their internet costs, which is very high, and having them even download a report, which can take hours. And so being able to call in or being able to, you know, zoom in for job trainings is going to be difficult. So I think that that's an issue that needs to be addressed very quickly, hopefully. This moves in actually into recommendations for the remote services. So I think feel like I kind of summed that up for, we need more into telehealth, online programs, again, expanding telehealth, virtual counseling, expanding that flexibility. But again, we also need to look at expanding the broadband so we can, so individuals can access that. And actually, this is one also another really good quote when thinking about individuals that are coming out of incarceration, knowing that they can't meet probation or parole requirements because of things that are put on them.
Yeah.
Oh, and I know we're getting up on time, so I'm just going to end here with the funding recommendations. As part of House Bill 66, they asked us to identify funding. And there is a lot of different funding out there, but I also want to state this. I do a lot of different work around public safety, MMIW, and as part of that, there is a report from the Not Invisible Act, the Not One More, where we did a deep dive into funding. And there are so many different barriers when it comes to being able to access all the different funding out there, especially when it comes to federal funding. And if any of you have tried to apply for federal grants and then comply with it, it is very difficult. It is often one-time funding. It is competitive grant funding. And Alaska continues not to receive a lot of the we're not on par with the rest of the lower 48 as far as funding for our tribes. And so within the report, you are going to see we did, when you read it, there's a lot of different funding opportunities. But I think that also proves that there is opportunities for tribes and for the state and for the federal government to start working together to be bringing that funding more into the state. So I hope that our tribes and our state can work together to bring that funding into the state to help support these programs and to support some of these recommendations. And we do have a number 9 that just came in from some of the listening sessions. I really appreciated the listening session, the people that came in and shared their experiences. Some of the things that really stuck out to me is really wanting the Department of Corrections to be at their community events, to start showing up, to be a part of these processes. Some of the comments I remember is saying making sure that there's job opportunities, people there that they want to work, they want to have opportunities, and they felt that Alaska Native men in particular were not having that opportunity to be able to have, they're getting picked last to be able to do jobs. Those were just things that the community shared, that a DOC was in the room, and I appreciated them being able to be there to hear that feedback and how we can come back and work together and address this, to address these issues that are coming from our community. So we are going to work together. And I know that there's lots for us to do moving forward, but I do want to hopefully move to seeing if Dr. Charlene Upbuck and Rick Garcia have any additional comments before we get on our 5 o'clock hours. They were our advisory team for this.
Sure. Who did you want to call on?
I'll call on Charlene Upbuck since she hasn't had a chance yet.
Dr. Upbuck? Can you hear us? There she is. Yep. If you could state your name and your affiliation, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, through the Chair Kawasaki. This is Dr. Charlene Upbuck, and I am the Executive Director at Data for Indigenous Justice. Yeah, thank you all so much for this presentation, the hard work of our partners on this report. You've all been provided so much information, and there's even more appendices with more information. And, you know, taking a few steps back from this, I think we can see that the result of what we have at hand is from solutions not being funded over time. And we see structural changes that really need to happen in order for us to make some real change on these issues. We have the information. This isn't new. These are things that we've been talking about that arise in across sectors. And so the impact of funding these tribally led solutions and from the work of the people who are doing this each and every day from the UAF team that did all those amazing interviews and surveys, this is a chance to really make an impact across sectors that funds things that tribal leadership have been talking about and that we know. And so we have all the information. I think my, you know, my last final words and recommendations would be to really be bold and to try to start funding some of these things and seeing the ways that we can have intersectionality work for the benefit by investing in our people and these solutions that are before you. Koyana.
Thank you very much, Dr. Opak, for being online today. Is there another person to call on?
I think Rick Garcia was online if you wanted to add anything else too.
If Rick Garcia is online, there you are. Okay. If you'd like to add just a couple things.
Yes. And thank you, Chair Kawasaki, Vice Chair Bjorkman, and members of the committee for having us here today. Again, my name is Rick Haskins Garcia, and I serve as the Director of Law, Policy, and Tribal Justice for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, and also have served as an advisory team member for AFN on the study before you. I would like to begin by thanking the legislature for funding this study. I also want to thank and honor AFN, their team, and their research partners at UAF and UAA for building a genuine, indigenous-led effort that reflects real lives, real stories, and real solutions. I am excited by what was detailed in the report and look forward to the next steps, but this report is very much a beginning, not a conclusion. With 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska, I really urge this committee and the legislature to consider a second phase, one that deepens community engagement, expands reach, and connects findings to implementation benchmarks. As Kendra and Katie shared, the report points very clearly in several directions. Tribal courts must be expanded and better resourced. Parole and probation conditions must be reformed. Culturally grounded reentry housing must be funded. And we need a permanent Alaskan Native-led task force to continuously identify systemic improvements, because this issue spans too many agencies and really budget cycles for any one-time fix. And most importantly, we must invest upstream in prenatal care, early childhood mental health, and elder youth mentoring. The evidence, as you'll see in the report, is clear that these are the highest impact and most cost-effective interventions available. And finally, the data in the report tells a story that calls really on all of us, state, tribal, and federal partners, to do more together. This legislature created that mandate, and thankfully AFN answered the call with remarkable dedication. Now we have a roadmap, and I really look forward to working alongside this committee and our partners to follow it. Koyana.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Are there questions at this time? And this is a really comprehensive report. We appreciate that you were able to shoot through it in a half an hour or so, but it is definitely worth reading, definitely worth going through. Maybe we'll just open it up to questions at this point. Well, I guess I have a question. So on the, did you guys talk at all about something the reentry coalitions have pointed out to us is a big deal, how to deal with the jobs and not being able to find a job immediately after incarceration? Did you look at anything about barrier crimes or barriers to employment that have caused problems?
Is there anything in the interviews or no?
No. So this is Dr. Katie Cueva. No, we did not. And I think that that also highlights kind of the limitations on this report. Mm-hmm. So kind of as we outlined our scope, and you can see that, yes, I feel like we highlighted a number of things that are useful as a roadmap, but there is such a need for more. As you've already identified in a couple different ways, there's a lot of additional areas where I think there's expertise that exists that we haven't tapped into yet.
Yeah. And I'll just add on, Kendra Kloster, again, I would echo that with Katie, is there's each one of those things cited in House Bill 66 could definitely been one of its own studies. It's very comprehensive, and it was a lot of trying to come up with working on through the recommendations for each one of these. And I really wish Doreen could be here. She actually passed away in December, unfortunately, but she was a very big help, and she was one of our advisory team members, and she was the CEO of Partners for Progress, which is a reentry program. And so she, if she was here, she would be able to answer that question for you. But there, that she was a partner in this project, and I think that one of the things that we want to do, this is not a project, this is a starting point, I think, for AFN, where we want to be able to take this and continue to move on and figure out how we're going to move forward on the recommendations and deepen what we've started here today.
Thank you, Ms. Kloster. I think that it's true what Mr. Garcia said about being a beginning, not a conclusion. I think for sure there's a lot of things to digest here in this large report, and I think each of the key recommendations could easily be its own bill or its own task force. I sit on a couple different budget subcommittees. The Senate co-chair, Donnie Olson, actually who represents Western Alaska, is on the law and courts budget subcommittees, public safety subcommittees, and corrections. I think those are three key agencies that we just talked about and addressed here. And so when it comes to the budget cycle issues, I'm sure we'll be talking about those, and we might bring you guys back again for that. Are there any final comments or questions before we adjourn the Senate State Affairs Committee? All right. Just wanted to thank once again Kendra Kloster and Dr. Katie Cueva for presenting. We wanted to thank Sandy Martinson from the Director of Institutions from the Department of Corrections. And I just wanted to note that on Tuesday, February 24th, we will hear a presentation and overview from the Department of Corrections. I'm not sure if we've received that yet, but there's a lot of questions that have arisen from this report. We will also hear Senate Bill 237. It's a bill entitled Data Sharing and Social Security by the Senate State Affairs Committee. If there's no other business to bring to the committee, we are adjourned at 5:04 p.m.